And welcome back to Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. It's our Veterans Day edition. Thank you and salutes to those who defended our country and remembrance of those who perished or were injured. Today we discuss the American military and our perceptions of it with Andrew Basevich. He was a U.S. Army officer for 23 years, a West Pointer, and he's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His latest book is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. And he joins us from Boston. Welcome to you, Mr. Basevich.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Professor. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You say that the U.S. military, the world's best military, doesn't win wars. Is that because the wars are just unwinnable, or is it something else?
No easy answer to the question, but part of the argument in my book is that if we look at the long course of U.S. military history, at the wars we've won, one of the defining characteristics is that those wars were fought by citizen armies. When Lincoln raised up an army to preserve the Union, it was not professional soldiers who fought and won, it was citizen soldiers. Same can be said about the war that we fought when Wilson sent doughboys to France or World War II. Since Vietnam, when we abandoned the citizen soldier tradition in favor of what we call an all-volunteer force, but what is really a professional military, we haven't done so well. We didn't win in Iraq. We're not going to win in Afghanistan, despite the admirable characteristics of that all-volunteer force. And it seems to me that given the importance that we attribute to American military power, we got to try to figure out why we don't win. And arguably, perhaps reviving the tradition of the citizen soldier might provide us with a military which, A, can win, and which the U.S. government would be somewhat more cautious about employing.
Professor, you had a 23-year military career. Tell us about it. You're a Vietnam veteran and also went to West Point. Just give us a little background.
Well, I don't know, it's not a particularly remarkable career. I did graduate from the Military Academy in 1969, went to Vietnam from 70 to 71, then spent another 20 or so fairly unremarkable years serving in mostly in troop units in Germany, in the States. Really, my military career coincided with the second half of the Cold War, and I left in 1992, shortly after the Cold War had ended.
What brought you to academia?
The grace of God and the kindness of strangers. I mean, when I left the military in 1992, we had four kids and bills to pay, and I needed a job, and I tended to fall into this business, which I've enjoyed tremendously and have found to be very rewarding, but I wouldn't tell you that it was a result of some master plan on my part, that's for sure.
Is the premise of your book at its basic that today's wars are fought and Americans still just kind of go to the mall?
Well, that's one of the key points. I mean, if you asked me to summarize the book in a sentence or so, I'd say that the relationship between the military and society, which on the surface appears healthy, is not. I think that the rhetoric of supporting the troops is not insincere. That would be unfair. But it doesn't have a lot of substance to it. And that troubles me deeply. I mean, the issue here is not simply that we don't win our wars and that they've turned out to be much longer and more costly than anybody expected. The issue here is that, in my judgment, the state subjects our soldiers to abuse, and we the people allow it to happen. And I think that's doesn't speak well of our democracy, and quite frankly, I think is wrong. So my argument on behalf of restoring the tradition of the citizen soldier is partly that maybe we'd have a better chance of achieving a favorable outcome, but also partly that perhaps a people engaged, genuinely engaged, with the well-being of their soldiers would be able to impose restraints on Washington's otherwise reckless, I think, tendency to misuse our military.
I have so many questions for you, Professor, but I'm just thinking the draft didn't work during Vietnam. We had draftees fleeing to Canada. Others were conscientious objectors, pacifists looking for any viable deferment.
Yes.
And so many drafted who didn't want to be there. Was that better?
No. I mean, it's an excellent question. And my response is, well, first of all, the citizen soldier tradition will not guarantee that we will avoid stupid wars, but also that the Vietnam War stands out as one that was peculiarly ill-advised and ill-managed, so much so that the willingness of Americans to accept conscription as the means whereby the citizen soldier tradition was maintained, that willingness simply collapsed under the stress of Vietnam. And my hope would be that would not occur again. Now, I would want to also add that the book is not a call for conscription. I mean, I think that conscription is politically infeasible. What the book suggests is that perhaps it's time for us to have a conversation about national service, a program of national service. Many of your listeners will know the difference between national service and conscription. National service basically says that every young American, male and female, owes a term of service to country and or community, and that some young people will serve that term of service in uniform, in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and others will do so in other capacities. But the principle here is that everyone will serve in some capacity, and that very much distinguishes that approach from the approach that occurred during Vietnam, when just a few were singled out, and they were singled out in ways that allowed people of privilege to evade service, whereas ordinary folks were swept up in a draft for this exceedingly ill-advised war.
I just want you to remind us of why Nixon ended the draft and the state of the military, the U.S. military, at that time.
Well, my argument, I think it's an argument shared by other historians, is that when Nixon became president, remember he ran for the presidency saying that he had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have a secret plan. When he became president, he wanted to find a way to manage the conclusion of the Vietnam War such that it would, from his point of view, do the least amount of damage to U.S. Credibility. I mean, the phrase he used at the time was he was seeking a peace with honor. In Nixon's conception and in Kissinger's conception, Vietnam was a piece on a chessboard, but not necessarily the most important piece. The other pieces that were more important were the Soviet Union and China. I mean, to make a long story short, what he wanted to do was to, in fact, extend the Vietnam War, not because he was trying to win it, but because he was trying to extricate ourselves without admitting defeat.
Mm-hmm.
In order to extend the war, he needed to, in a sense, buy time domestically. And in order to do that, he decided what he wanted to do was take the wind out of the sails of the anti-war movement. And what better way to do that than to announce that the draft was going away? So the elimination of the draft and the creation of the all-volunteer force, at least in a near term, was dictated by Nixon's calculation of domestic political imperatives.
Go ahead, Professor.
No,
I'm sorry. I'm saying that isn't today's all-volunteer services, though, also a route that many middle-income and low-income kids are able to get to college?
Well, Not as many as one might think. I mean, first of all, we should be clear that those who would say that the all-volunteer force of the present day is, you know, consists of people who have no other alternative, no other options, that's unfair. The people who join the military, who are recruited for the military, tend to be kids who have completed high school, and therefore have demonstrated some amount of talent and of self-discipline. But they're not necessarily kids who, were they to not join the Army, would, you know, be going to Harvard on a full scholarship. There is a class bias, and the people who run our country, who are in national politics, or who are running major corporations, or who run major newspapers and networks, so the people who run our universities, their kids are not in the military. And in that sense, we have certainly an elite that is the people who make decisions regarding war and peace have become increasingly detached from the military, and I think that's not a good thing.
I'd like to continue where we're leaving off. We need to take a short break. We're speaking with Professor Andrew Bacevich. He's an author, and he's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His latest book is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. And let's take that short break, and we'll come back. And welcome back to Topical Currents on this Monday. It's Veterans Day. We're speaking with Andrew Bacevich. He's an author and professor of history and international relations at Boston University. Served 23 years as an officer in the U.S. Army. He's a retired colonel. And his latest book is entitled Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Professor, I want to pick up where we left off. Did you happen to listen to Morning Edition this morning, Cokie Roberts?
I did not. I'm sorry.
Well, you say that a problem is that precious few sons and daughters of the members of Congress are serving in the military. But Cokie Roberts took it another step. She said she was talking to David Green. She spoke of a time when the Congress was comprised largely of veterans themselves, right, after World War II and even Vietnam, and how the parties worked better together and were more cautious about going to war, that they themselves were comprising the Congress. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I think the point has merit, although, again, one would not want to overstate it. A minute ago, I was suggesting that elite institutions didn't have a contact with the military, and indeed are not being run by very few veterans rise to the top of these elite institutions. And I do think that it's particularly because our country places so much importance on possessing and wielding military power. I think it would be a good thing for all elite institutions, not just the Congress, but some of the others that I mentioned, to have a seasoning of people who have had military service, not because you've got to have been in the military in order to make a wise decision about whether or not to go to war or how to wage a war, but because some amount of exposure to military life and perhaps to active service in a time of war can, I think, ensure a sense of realism and prudence. So I think that the point that Cokie Roberts is making was a valid one.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email. That's radio@WLRN.org. Bonnie, you have an emailer?
Well, we do. Somebody who agrees with you. Carlos wrote something a few years ago regarding our current notion of patriotism in the U.S. Am I the only one who's uncomfortable with the way we treat our men and women in uniform? For certain, we salute them. We don't miss an opportunity to say thank you for your service. And then he talks about at airports, those in uniform are allowed to board first, and no politician misses a chance to express how grateful he or she is for the service of these young men and women. Yes, we feel good, we feel proud, we feel so patriotic. All the while, we keep our distance. We let others bear the burden and responsibilities of war as we step back and share in none of the burden.
Well, yes. I mean, in many respects, that's a useful summary of the of the book that I've just written. There's a phrase, cheap grace, credited to the German theologian and martyr Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Comes from a book that he wrote back in the 30s when he was living in Nazi Germany. And Bonhoeffer's notion of cheap grace is that it is behavior that, in essence, makes you feel good, even as you allow evil or objectionable behavior to occur. He was basically tagging the Christian churches of Germany at the time. The pastors would proclaim that the Germans who went to church were being good Christians and fulfilling their responsibility as Christians, even as they turned a blind eye to the crimes of the Nazi state. And I think, again, not wishing to push the comparison with Nazi Germany, something of the same thing, I think, is evident today in the relationship between American society and the military, that there's a lot of posturing. There are some people who are engaged in doing serious work on behalf of our veterans, unquestionably. But for the majority, it's posturing, it's gestures. And the gestures make us feel good, but they don't have any meaningful, they don't make a meaningful contribution to the well-being of those who serve and who have served. And in that sense, I think that's what sticks in the craw of the person who sent you that email, and that bothers me as well, and was part of the reason that I wrote this book.
But what would you have Americans do? I mean, when we were going to go into Iraq, there was impassioned public opposition against going there here and abroad.
Yeah.
And I would say most Americans, you say it's barely a memory for most Americans, but I would say most Americans decried that war for the loss of American life, Iraqi life, trillions of dollars, the false pretenses. Is that not true?
Congress passed a resolution.
I understand that, but there was a lot of public outcry by you're talking about society at large.
There was, but now two points, if I may. The first is, and yes, there was a great deal of public protest. Coincidentally happened to be in Manhattan. I don't remember the date. It was right around Valentine's Day in 2003, which was the date of the worldwide demonstrations against the coming war in Iraq, a war that everybody knew was in the planning stages. And the turnout of people in New York was, to me, astonishing. All kinds of people, young, old, black, white, male, female, you know, straight, gay, you name it, fill in the streets, and it had no effect whatsoever on the decision-making in the Bush administration. Why not? Well, part of my argument is because by 2003, the army had become Washington's army. It wasn't our army. This professional army was the army that belonged to the state, and therefore we, the people, really had no say. We could raise a clamor, but authorities in Washington felt no obligation to pay attention to those who thought that the war was going to be a bad idea. But back to your question, which was, what would you have us do?
Yes.
I mean, one thing I think what I would have us do is pay for the wars. I mean, even if you are persuaded, a person would be persuaded that the professional military that we have provides the basis for a sound military system, let's pay for the wars that we sent them to fight. We haven't paid for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We've basically just put the costs on our credit card, and the costs are going to be passed down to a future generation. If engaging in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are indeed vital to the interests of our country, then we should pay more in taxes, or we should reduce our claim to entitlements. But that didn't happen. So that's one thing we could do.
Let's take a call or two. We have Dwight in Pembroke Pines. Hi there.
Hi. First of all, happy Veterans Day. And as a 3rd Infantry vet, I spent a majority of my time over in Germany. And my grandfather, who raised me, who was also a 3ID vet, told me the same exact thing that your speaker has, is that we can wage wars, my generation, but we can't win them. And but he doesn't blame it on the heart of the soldier. He believes that the politicians don't have the stomach for what's really necessary in the dirty business of war. If you look at some of the more successful operations, you're talking about Sherman through Savannah, any of the Genghis Khan, all through Mongolia. Those were not popular people. But nowadays, it's ironic that with the more technology we introduce into warfare, the less effective we actually are. So, and also my second point is there anyone, any standing military that's actually doing it right, that's winning these wars and, you know, making reparations? You know, we dropped the bomb on Japan, and they're pretty much our BFF now. I'll take my comment off the air.
Okay.
Thank you again for your service.
Thank you. Professor?
Let me address the point of doing the hard things that would seem to be necessary to achieve real victory. And the caller made reference to Sherman's March to the Sea. I'd put that in a somewhat larger context. Back in 1861, when the war began, both the United States government and Confederate authorities believed that the war would be won quickly. They each thought their side would win quickly, that basically with a battle or two, that the enemy would give way. That turned out to be a vast error in judgment on both sides. President Lincoln learned over time that winning was going to be tough, and that it would require many battles, that victory would come by slowly grinding away at the ability of the Confederacy to wage war, bringing the Confederacy to its knees, and that's when it would end. And when he hired people like Ulysses S. Grant and William T. Sherman, he found generals who shared that view of the war and were able to implement his plan. But you know, the piece of the equation here was that Lincoln brought the American people more generally around to that point of view. And therefore, he was able to raise up a vast army in order to implement the plan that Sherman and Grant were charged with. What we have in our post-Vietnam professional military is that the state doesn't have that ability to raise up a great force necessary to win, because we the people, have been allowed to conclude that war is not our business. Now, as a practical matter, what that meant in Iraq and Afghanistan is when the expectations of the war planners turned out to be wrong. Remember that the Bush administration expected the Afghanistan war and especially the Iraq war to be short. They both turned out to be very long. But because the people are not engaged in war, the administration didn't have the option of raising up great legions that might have been able to actually bring about victory. So what'd they do instead? What they did instead was turn to contractors, to turn to people who are, in fact, mercenaries. And the mercenaries have cost us a ton of money, but have also turned out to be ineffective. So part of the argument here is that victory comes when the people, who are the real sinews of military power, when the people are engaged in the cause. And that simply doesn't seem to be feasible any longer.
Tell us more about these private contractors. Who are they? And were their responsibilities, were they actually fighting? What do they do?
Well, the military used to be relatively self-sufficient. When I was in Vietnam, for example, there were contractors in Vietnam. But their responsibilities were relatively peripheral. I mean, we fed ourselves. We cooked our meals. We disposed of our own waste. We secured base camps. Soldiers drove the trucks that delivered supplies to wherever the supplies needed to go. what we have found in recent years is that much of that self-sufficiency has been traded away, and an increasingly broad range of functions have been turned over to these contractors, some of them really involving quasi-combat roles. Why do the contractors agree to take on these responsibilities in a combat zone? Because it's a way to make money. And my point there is that it's always been true that war has been a profit-making enterprise for some people. It's always been people who have seen war as a way to enrich themselves. But what we find ourselves today is in a circumstance in which many, many people have come to see war as a way to enrich themselves. They're not interested in defending freedom. They're not interested in keeping America safe. They're interested in the bottom line.
Let's take another call or two. We've got Stephen in Pembroke Pines. Hi there.
Hello.
Hello.
Professor, good afternoon. I have so much to say, and I know a short period of time. First of all, I want to thank the officers who got my, back home alive. They're completely under, we have not begun to show appreciation for these officers, such as yourself, who got us home intact. I do have PTSD, and I was in the 196th Light Infantry. I was on the Cambodian operation, depicted in the movie Platoon. I was part of that disaster. But when I came home, I went to New York University, joined Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I was part of the coffee house, anti-war coffee house, GI movement, where I was shot at. I was shot at by ultra-right-wing Minutemen, COVID, ultra-Minutemen, radical right-wingers, while on peace marches. So I come back from Vietnam, the Vietnamese were shooting at us. I come back, and my own citizens are shooting at us. Second of all, I want to say that I saw two locomotives heading up towards each other right now, and that is veterans who need care, they need raises and compensation, attention, but we have these stupid Tea Party faction up who are basically spoiled brats, in my opinion, who basically can't afford a second summer home, and they're protesting they don't want to pay for the bills that were in the last four or five wars. It really makes me extremely angry to hear people who sat silently during the last several wars, and all of a sudden they're very concerned about the debt. First of all, we were sent off, drafted, and a bill is due. And we're in our senior years now, this group of Vietnam veterans that I fall within. I have contacted Wasserman Schultz's office and Mr. Hastings' office, and I want to see a bill, a reparations bill, that's set aside to try to have some address, redress, for this group of Vietnam veterans who were basically screwed over.
Stephen, you covered a lot of ground and were sympathetic, but let's let the professor touch on some.
Okay, all right, Joe, sorry.
Well, could Stephen just, what was exactly the question that he wanted to pose?
Well, it's not a question, it's just a matter of, to me, it's very obvious that the American people, as you say, this is a separation, a wall between the consciousness of the civilian population and the military veteran communities. It's frightening.
Well, that's the premise of the professor's book. Could you explain?
I guess what I would say is I agree. I think that you have personally directly experienced in painful ways the circumstance that I am writing about, although my own writing tends to focus more on the policy implications of the problem. You are personalizing the issue.
There's a lot of emotion out there, isn't there, Professor?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think there's a lot of emotion. There's a lot of there's a certain amount of confusion. My sense is that, and maybe it's only because this is what I'm writing about, but my writing gets a certain amount of resonates with some people, and they send me emails. My sense is that there is a rising level of discomfort on this matter. either, I think it's next weekend, I may be wrong, the Northwestern University football team is playing University of Michigan, and the Northwestern, somebody's idea of a PR stunt, the Northwestern football team, football uniform has been redesigned for this game to pay tribute to veterans, and you have to see it to believe it, but basically it has red streaks that would appear to be bleeding wounds on the uniform. Now, somebody, I'm sure good-hearted person at Northwestern thinks that this is a way to pay tribute to those who have served and sacrificed. But I think there's a growing number of people who see that kind of a stunt and say that it's a stunt, that there's something verging on obscene. There's something so out of whack with what it would mean to genuinely be supportive of and appreciative of those who serve.
We have an emailer, David. He says, my daughter will be listening with her debate partner. The following are her arguments as to why the volunteer force causes harm. Can the professor help with comments in the discussion? And one of them is that false promises from recruiters encourages belligerence in government officials who are eager for war, discourages patriotism and community, and promotes indifference.
Well, I don't know about the false promises, but I think the last point is one that I would endorse and probably suggest that be emphasized, the indifference. Again, on the surface, there's not indifference. On the surface, there are expressions of support. I mean, the earlier reference to, you know, if you're in uniform, you can board first when you're
right.
getting on a commercial airplane. But substantively, there's indifference. I received an email today from an acquaintance who pays particular attention to veterans going to college, and in particular about whether the admission of veterans into elite colleges and universities, you know, those who get to go to Princeton and Yale and Williams and Amherst and places like that. And what his research shows is that, guess what? Very few go there. And I think that is one small example of the indifference. I can assure you that the presidents of Yale and Princeton and Williams and Amherst pay very close attention to all kinds of other diversity markers, whether it's race, gender, sexual orientation, geography, but somehow or other making sure that the student body is open to a certain number of veterans doesn't seem to matter, doesn't seem to figure in their calculations. And I think that's an example, a small example, but not a trivial one, of the indifference.
Of course, so many of the so-called greatest generation not only were educated, but were able to get low-interest loans for homes under the GI Bill.
Yeah, but again, see, they were us.
Right.
I mean, that was our army. You know, that was my dad, my mom. It was not Washington's army that fought and won World War II. And therefore, the system needed to be more genuinely responsive to the needs and the concerns of that generation of veterans, because they were us.
And another caller, this is Siobhan in Hollywood. Hi there.
Hi, and good afternoon. And I want to just say thank you very much to the professor for his service to our country and for the sacrifices that his family especially has endured, that he still continues to be, to speak out and to care about is a testament to his patriotism, and I just thank him very much.
Okay. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
What are your feelings about the high unemployment rate among veterans of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq? I heard this morning it's now 10%.
Well, I mean, we're sort of stacking up the evidence about indifference. One could also point to the notoriously bad performance of the Department of Veterans Affairs. you know, if we cared, if the people cared, if Washington cared, that wouldn't happen. If people really cared about veterans finding jobs, then we wouldn't have an unemployment rate that is higher than the rest of the country. And again, I don't want to be misunderstood as suggesting that nobody cares, that everybody is indifferent.
Right.
That would not be fair. That would not be true. But the numbers end up speaking for themselves.
I see a lot of people looking for handouts on the highway ramps and that, and they have, I don't know the veracity of these signs, but many of them say, you know, veteran, I need a meal, and or in some pretty bad shape.
Yeah, we have them here in Boston, too. I mean, I don't have the statistics, but, I mean, you get a sense that the homeless population is increasing, and there are some number of people on the streets who have their handwritten cardboard sign, and whether it's true or not, they say they're vets.
I'm interested to know where you stand on drone strikes in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, Professor.
Well, I think that you know, I recognize that there are terrorists who want to kill us, want to kill Americans, and I have no problem with killing them first before they can do their dirty deed. I'm troubled by two aspects of the program. One is, are we in fact killing terrorists as opposed to non-combatants? And to the extent that we're killing non-combatants, and we are killing some of them, then you wonder if the gain made by taking out some Al-Qaeda operative outweighs the loss of fueling additional anti-Americanism. I mean, there is a trade-off there, and it needs to be examined. But more broadly, my problem is that it ain't a strategy. War is the continuation of politics. War ultimately is about politics. What is the political objective served by the campaign of drone strikes? I don't see any. How many people will we have to kill before we'll be able to say, okay, we've now achieved our objective, and therefore we can stop killing people with drone strikes? So there's a failure of creative thinking in the Obama administration. I mean, the president, it's not that the president has learned nothing from the failures and disappointments of the past decade. The president learned that invading and occupying countries is a bad idea. You know, his predecessor tried that in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and it didn't work out too well. But what the president did, what it has done, is to devise an alternative to invading and occupying countries, and it's drone strikes, air strikes, and relying on special operations forces. Now, the costs are less, the risks are less, but there's no connection between Obama's approach to warfare and larger political purpose. So the war on terror has continued under President Obama, whether or not he uses that phrase. But it's a war on terror that in many respects is now devoid of an overarching political purpose, and that's a problem.
We're speaking with Professor Andrew Bacevich. He teaches history and international relations at Boston University. His latest book is entitled Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. We need to take one more short break, and we'll come back and take more calls.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Professor Andrew Bacevich. We resume our conversation about the U.S. military on this Veterans Day. If you have the day off, we hope you are having an enjoyable day. Let's take a few more calls. We've got David. He's in Miami. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask Professor Bacevich, well, I would like to tell him, I'd like to thank him for his service. Also, it's not only Veterans Day, but it's also the anniversary of the end of World War I, and what he talks about, the way soldiers are treated, well, the way the veterans of World War I were treated was not much better, particularly when you remember the Bonus Army in 1932. The other thing, can he expound upon what kind of an impact National Security Advisor Donald Rumsfeld had on veterans affairs, veterans benefits, and the like? And I'll take his comments off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Geez, I don't know if I can. Rumsfeld, as Secretary of Defense, really didn't have any direct responsibility over veterans matters. I mean, once a serving member of the military leaves the military, becomes a veteran, then that individual is no longer under the purview of the Department of Defense. I mean, with regard to Rumsfeld's management of the Iraq War, which was the big war of his time, I mean, I think most people would say he did a pretty bad job. What's the responsibility of a Secretary of Defense? Well, make sure that the war plan is sound. And critics, I think, would say that the plan for invading Iraq in 2003 was deeply defective, and it was defective because it did not include a sound blueprint for how U.S. forces would occupy the country. In other words, to prevent the outbreak of the sort of violence that actually occurred. Secretary of Defense is supposed to ensure that the people in charge of the war, the generals, are up to the task. And Rumsfeld failed. When General Tommy Franks retired soon after the occupation of Baghdad, Rumsfeld appointed to replace Franks a general who was simply not up to the task, and that had adverse effects.
Who was that?
Ricardo Sanchez.
Okay.
General Ricardo Sanchez.
Let's take another caller.
The Secretary is responsible for ensuring that the force is appropriately equipped. They have the right stuff. And we ended up with troops who were riding around in soft-skin Humvees that were, in effect, being used as combat vehicles. And Rumsfeld was slow to correct that deficiency.
We're getting close to the end of our hour, and I want to work in this phone call, though. This is Jordan in Fort Lauderdale. He's a student. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing, guys? Thank you for taking my call today.
Mm-hmm.
As you just said, I'm a 25-year-old student, doctoral student. The only wars that I have known in my life that I can recall are these last two, Iraq and Afghanistan, which for my life and the people that I knew in it, you know, very spaced from, I don't feel I have much tangible grasp to anything that happened in wars or to many people that it really affected personally. But for a lot of people in my generation, what do you suggest for us to, you know, either move forward to change in this government and how they approach these wars, or to feel more attached to what happened to this kind of, you know, hired military government? Since it's not my brothers and sisters or friends that I grew up with, thankfully I'm an affluent person, I've had many privileges in my life, and so have my friends. You know, what do you suggest for my generation to really feel more of an impact on our life?
Well, I think that the big question is, what does it mean to be a citizen in our country? Does citizenship guarantees rights? It allows us to exercise prerogatives. Well, does citizenship entail obligations? Should it? And if it should, what are those obligations? I think that the definition, the prevailing definition of citizenship, has come to be very, very thin. And that thin definition of citizenship is what opens the door for people who do have power to misuse that power in ways that are contrary to the country's interests. So we need to rethink, redefine, and enrich our understanding of what it means to be a citizen in this democracy.
What do your compatriots feel, Jordan? You seem to have done a lot of thinking about this, but have your friends and other students?
I mean, you know, I'm studying to become a doctor, and it's something that never really comes up in our lives, in our conversation. you know, unless someone has a very immediate family member who's been involved, you know, our sense of what we represent and what we do does not touch anything near to the fact that our country even has a military and that goes towards military action. You know, a lot of it, I think, has to do with the fact that our country is built in incredible debt that, to this point, doesn't seem like we truly want to make amends to pay it off. And that someday something will change, hopefully for our generation, that we figure out a way to. But for now, it doesn't seem like there's any real pull for us to get involved, you know, either financially, supportively, or any reason to really think about it.
Well, thanks for calling, Jordan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor, we only have about a minute left, but I want to know if you had any thoughts about the latest developments with Iran and the limits on their nuclear program. And we just have about, well, Joe's looking at me. We don't have long for you to, I know.
Well, I mean, my hope is that we will not go to war with Iran. My hope is that this effort to negotiate some kind of a resolution will succeed. And I think that we can take heart from the fact that there does seem to have been a change in the Iranian perspective. That they have been sending out numerous signals indicating that they would welcome a deal in order to try to remove the economic sanctions, which would appear to have had a pretty punishing effect. So, you know, let's keep our fingers crossed.
Well, we want to thank you. Professor Andrew Basevich teaches history and international relations at Boston University, served 23 years as an officer. He's a retired colonel. And his latest book is entitled Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. We want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And thanks for tuning in. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Help from Lorenzo Ponce de Leon as well. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information and cool links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Pictures of Bonnie Berman, Linda Gassenheimer, Fred Tasker, Paul Leary, et al. Tomorrow's program discusses how good citizenship can be revived in this age of pessimism with Tufts University Professor Peter Levine. He says, we are the ones we've been waiting for. And to the calendar. On this day in 1821, 192 years ago, the birth of Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky in St. Petersburg. He was a literary celebrity at age 24, exiled to Siberia, suffered an acute gambling compulsion, and influenced James Joyce and Hemingway. And on this day in 1964, 49 years ago, the birth of Ally McBeal, actress Callista Flockhart in Freeport, Illinois. Her father was a bigwig at Kraft Foods. She began playing a babysitter on The Guiding Light. One more while we digest some good old cornpone humor. On this day in 1973, 40 years ago, the death of hee-haw banjo whiz David Aikman. He and his wife were murdered by burglars in their rural home. String Bean was a clawhammer-style banjoist. So we leave with a thought from Dostoevsky, who was also epileptic. Quote, happiness does not lie in happiness, but in the achievement of it. Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Stay with us. Next, it's Here and Now from NPR News.